Imagine trying to paint a brutal tear gas-filled street riot using the delicate pastel watercolors you'd normally use to paint, I don't know, a quiet summer meadow.
Right. I mean, it shouldn't mathematically work at all.
It really shouldn't. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are super thrilled to have you with us as we explore an artwork that operates on, well, a massive contradiction.
A really fascinating one, yeah.
So we're looking at a piece called Puerto Resistencia, mm-hmm. created by the artist Jared Duque. He actually details the creation and the whole philosophy of this specific watercolor in his book, Trastio Pintura Artistica.
Specifically, we're looking at a chapter titled Protesta, right?
Exactly. And our mission today is to explore how this incredibly specific artwork manages to capture the intense, massive 2021 Colombian social uprisings against government abuse and police repression.
Yeah, because to truly understand art born out of conflict, we have to examine the creator's arguments and, you know, the raw emotion of the street and decode how those elements are actually translated into visual language. Mm. Puerto Resistencia acts as a vital anchor for a moment of extreme historical complexity. It takes the fleeting, chaotic energy of a protest and cements it into a permanent document.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we go any further, I really need to establish a very strict rule for our conversation today.
Yeah, that's crucial here.
It is. The source materials we're diving into contain some extremely charged political language.
Yeah.
Like, the author explicitly accuses the administration of former Colombian President Iván Duque of, quote, barbarism and literal institutional crime.
Heavy words.
Very heavy. So the unbreakable rule of this deep dive is that neither of us sitting at this microphone validates, endorses, or debates these political stances. We are entirely neutral.
Absolutely.
Our sole objective is to investigate how the artist took those specific claims, the collective pain of the street, and those historical grievances, and weaponized them into a piece of art.
Right, because the painting simply doesn't exist in a neutral vacuum. I mean, it is a product of its highly politicized environment. But our analysis of how the artwork functions mechanically, conceptually, and aesthetically, that has to remain impartial. We are looking at the mechanics of the expression, not judging the politics behind it.
For sure. So with that mandatory impartiality disclaimer firmly in place, let's jump right into the core contradiction of this artwork, because it is wild.
It really is.
When you think of the watercolor medium historically, your mind instantly goes to a feeling of lightness. You picture, like, translucent landscapes, pastel colors gently bleeding into one another.
Smooth brush strokes that barely graze the surface of the paper.
Exactly. It dictates a very quiet, delicate emotion.
And historically, that is the undisputed visual language of watercolor. Water and diluted pigment have this centuries-old tradition of suggesting fragility and peaceful contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
It's an imagery of harmonization. A watercolor artist is usually engaged in a highly controlled, gentle dance with the medium, sort of coaxing the water across the paper.
But then Jared Duque takes this traditionally fragile medium and uses it to document young people facing down riot gear on the asphalt.
Yeah.
It is such a jarring clash of subject and medium.
Yeah, it's a total paradox.
But, like, one of the sources put it perfectly, it's like trying to play heavy metal on a harp.
Wow, yeah.
You are taking an instrument designed for lullabies and forcing it to scream.
And that inherent incompatibility is actually the entire point of the piece. The technique itself has to experience a rebellion against its own history in order to function.
Okay, wait, explain that a bit more.
Well, to grasp the protest portrayed on the canvas, you have to look at the physical act of its creation, what the author actually calls the violence of the execution. The artist literally weaponized the watercolor medium.
Weaponize it? That's such a strong phrase. Because when I think of watercolor, I think of a wet brush softly dabbing paper. So for an execution to be violent, the materials themselves have to change, right?
Oh, absolutely. And Jared Duque made a very specific structural choice here. He painted this on 640-gram, cold-pressed, coarse-grain Arches paper.
Okay, let's pause there for a second.
It's a 15-by-11-inch format using heavy Daniel Smith pigments.
Right. And for you listening, just to put that paperweight into context, standard printer paper on your desk is about 70 or 80 grams.
Yeah, it's super thin.
Even professional standard watercolor paper is usually around 300 grams. A 640-gram sheet is essentially a slab of rigid cardboard.
It is. It is manufactured specifically to take a severe amount of physical punishment without disintegrating into a soggy mess.
But these normally would just fall apart.
Exactly. Usually, if you scrub standard paper with water and a stiff brush, it pills, it tears, it just falls apart entirely. The artist needed a substrate that could endure sheer friction and the physical force required to push thick, heavy pigment into a coarse grain.
What's fascinating here is how that thick, unyielding paper physically mirrors the people depicted in the painting.
Oh, that's a great point.
Right. The sources highlight that the frontline groups in these protests were made up of young people from historically marginalized neighborhoods. And when faced with what the author frames as severe state repression and a total lack of institutional protection, these kids had no armor. They had to use their physical bodies as a collective shield.
Their actual physical existence on the asphalt became the barrier against institutional violence.
Right.
And the material choice of the 640-gram paper is a direct conceptual parallel. Just as those marginalized youth use their physical bodies to resist the riot police, that heavy, rigid paper physically resists the aggression of the paint, the water, and the brush.
It's absorbing the blows.
Exactly. The paper has to be tough enough to survive the brutal process of its own creation, just like the protesters had to be tough enough to survive the front line.
It completely upends our understanding of how water behaves in art. There's a striking note from the text that rejects the idea of watercolor being transparent and airy.
Yeah, that part is really interesting.
It says, in this painting, water does not soften. It accumulates, dirties, strikes. The artist strips the water of its historical romanticism and turns it into a dense, murky, aggressive element.
The water becomes heavy with dark pigment, overlapping in these dense layers that mimic the soot and chaos of the street.
Yeah.
And that aggression dictates the entire psychological effect of the composition.
The composition itself feels suffocating. Jairo Duque completely removes any classical depth of field.
No sky at all.
Right, there is no sky. There are no buildings in the background to give you a sense of scale. The figures are crammed together into this compact, ascending block. It feels like a concrete retaining wall of human beings moving forward to confront you.
And denying the viewer any visual relief is incredibly intentional. I mean, in a traditional landscape, your eyes can escape the foreground and rest on a peaceful horizon in the distance.
Take a breather, basically.
Exactly. But here, you are trapped in the moment. The claustrophobia forces you to confront the human mass face to face.
Wow.
You are plunged right into the density of the protest, unable to look away from the physical reality of the front line.
And when you are forced to look that closely at the mass, you start to see what the sources call the visual vocabulary of the front line.
Yeah, the details are incredible.
It is a visual language born entirely out of extreme precarity. We aren't looking at professional shields or standard issue armor.
Not at all.
We are looking at half-cut metal barrels dragged from construction sites. We are looking at plastic hard hats. We are seeing teenagers wearing swimming goggles to protect their eyes from military-grade tear gas. It is poverty transformed into defensive armor.
The author uses the phrase the aesthetics of scarcity, which is vital for understanding the resourcefulness of this movement.
The aesthetics of scarcity. I like that.
Yeah. Everyday objects, things associated with manual labor, traffic control, or even a trip to a public pool, they are forcibly repurposed for survival in a conflict zone.
It's wild to think about.
And the text emphasizes that this creates a completely non-hierarchical human mass where the collective crowd itself is the true protagonist of the artwork, not any single hero.
Okay, but wait. If the author insists this is a non-hierarchical mass where everyone is equal, then I have to point out a massive visual contradiction in the painting.
Oh, you mean the arm?
Yes, the arm, right in the exact center, bursting out of this claustrophobic crowd, is a monumental, disproportionately giant arm holding a shield with the word resist.
Yeah, it definitely draws the eye immediately.
But usually, when you see a giant central figure towering over a crowd in political art, it symbolizes a caudillo.
Hmm.
You know, a traditional military strongman or a supreme dictator directing the masses from above. Doesn't that go against the whole non-hierarchical thing?
It is a stark visual anomaly for sure, but the author explicitly rejects the caudillo interpretation.
Okay.
That giant arm isn't meant to glorify a specific individual with a name and a face barking orders at troops.
So if it's not a supreme leader, then that arm must represent some kind of structural concept. It looks almost like a patchwork, a physical amalgam of everyone standing beneath it.
Yeah.
Like an externalization of their collective muscle.
That is precisely how it functions. It symbolizes a collective will.
Hmm.
Visually, a horizontal mass of people creates a very heavy, oppressive line across the canvas.
Right. Weighs the image down.
Yeah. Exactly. So that monumental arm is designed to break that heavy horizontal weight and force the energy of the painting aggressively upward.
Oh, I see.
It tells the viewer that this wasn't just a physical clash of bodies pushing against each other on the street. It was a vertical, ethical and political uprising driven by massive collective indignation.
It's the sum of all their forces channeled into a single upward gesture of resistance. And you see that resistance physically carried in the objects they hold, specifically the colors painted on those improvised shields.
The color palette here is deeply, deeply political.
Yeah, you see the yellow, blue, and red of the Colombian flag repeated throughout the work. But these aren't the pristine, vibrant state emblems you'd see waving cleanly over a federal government building.
Not even close. They are battered, fragmented, and stained. The national colors are painted onto scraps of wood and tattered clothes,
mm-hmm.
and they are inextricably mixed with the smoke grays, the dark greens of the opposing riot gear, and the urban ochres of the street itself.
The source actually argues this is a very deliberate ideological reclamation.
Mm-hmm.
By painting the flag and the dirt and the smoke, the painting makes a visual argument that the nation doesn't belong exclusively to the political elites in their clean offices.
Right.
The nation actually belongs to the people suffering in extreme inequality. They're reclaiming the symbol of the country right there on the stained asphalt.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, that stained asphalt isn't just an abstract concept of the street. The painting is anchored to very specific geographic coordinates of pain in Colombia.
Real places.
Exactly. The faces under those construction helmets and swimming goggles represent physical places that took on legendary status during the 2021 uprisings in the city of Cali and the Valle del Cauca region.
The author explicitly names these territorial landmarks, which I think is so important. We have Puerto Resistencia, which obviously gives the artwork its name.
Right.
But also places like La Luna, El Puente de los 1,000 Días, and Siloé. Mm-hmm. These weren't just random intersections where a clash happened for a few hours and then everyone went home.
No, they ceased to be mere streets. They became prolonged blockades and permanent encampments, ultimately transforming into symbolic territories.
Which changes everything.
It does, because when you establish a prolonged blockade, you have to sustain it. These marginalized groups essentially had to create their own micro-societies at these intersections.
Wow, like building a city within a city.
Precisely. They set up community kitchens to feed people, makeshift first aid stations to treat injuries, and their own neighborhood security.
Right, because the state wasn't helping them.
Exactly, because the state was perceived as either entirely absent from their needs or actively aggressive toward them. These youth had to become the governing body of their microgeography. That is how a new idea of citizenship is forged on a street corner.
And the sources emphasize that this explosion of tension in those specific territories didn't just happen overnight. This wasn't a sudden reaction to a single policy on a Tuesday. This is a pressure cooker that had been building for generations. The painting represents the culmination of over 200 years of systemic political, social, and economic abandonment.
Two centuries of institutional social exclusion is the heavy historical backdrop against which this watercolor is painted.
Yeah.
The people holding those improvised shields weren't just a monolith of angry youth. They were a massive convergence of historically marginalized sectors.
The text lists an incredible coalition, actually. It mentions impoverished young people, indigenous groups defending their ancestral land rights, Afro-descendants, LGBTQ plus individuals, women, peasants, and urban workers.
It was a true cross-section of society.
It was a convergence of multiple citizenships that had historically been denied a voice, finally forcing the state to look at them. And while the painting captures this sweeping 200-year historical narrative, it doesn't just deal in big abstract generalizations.
No, it gets incredibly personal.
It does. The artist includes two specific real names to anchor the artwork in the brutal, fatal reality of the moment.
Because the human cost of the uprising has to be explicitly documented.
Mm-hmm.
The author brings in the story of Rebecca Linda Marlene Spurser, a German journalist who embedded herself with the frontline youth in Cali to document their lives.
Right. And she was subsequently expelled from the country by the authorities.
Yes. And then the text includes a much more tragic, irreversible event. The murder of Joan Sebastian Bonilla Bermudez, a young man who was a recognized leader within that frontline resistance.
By including those real names, the artist grounds this massive concept of resistance in real mortality. It proves this isn't a metaphor for the people who were there.
Exactly.
But the text makes a really fascinating distinction of how the art functions in relation to those names. It says the painting does not act as a judicial file.
Right, because a judicial file, by its very nature, seeks a conclusion.
Right, you want to close it.
Exactly. It exists to gather evidence, reach a verdict, close the case, and archive it away in a drawer so society can move forward. A judicial file is all about finality.
But the artwork operates in the exact opposite way. The author calls it an open wound.
An open wound.
Yeah. It fundamentally doesn't want to close the case. It demands continuous, uncomfortable attention to the trauma of that generation. It acts as a bulwark against state-sanctioned amnesia, refusing to let society just move on and forget what happened to people like Joan Sebastian.
It forces the viewer to sit with the discomfort of unresolved trauma. The author describes the painting as deliberately uncomfortable, loaded, and even excessive.
Which makes perfect sense when you look at it.
Yeah, the visual density of the watercolor has to physically match the massive historical weight of that 200 years of exclusion and the visceral pain of those lost lives.
But here is the ultimate irony of this visceral, tear gas-soaked painting. Okay, let's unpack this because here's where it gets really interesting.
I love this part.
When you look at it, it feels like you are standing in the middle of a street in Cali. But it wasn't painted on the streets of Colombia during the protests.
No, it wasn't.
It was painted over a year later, in October of 2022. And it was painted thousands of miles away in Whittier, California.
The geography of its creation is completely removed from the geography of the trauma.
It's crazy. And the reference material Jairo Duque used wasn't a sketchbook he carried around the barricades.
Right.
He used fleeting, ephemeral digital pixels. He sourced cell phone videos, shaky live streams, and social media images that were circulating frantically on the web before disappearing into the algorithm's feed.
It is a remarkable act of cultural alchemy, honestly. The artist takes the most precarious, highly localized, and ephemeral expressions of street pain, you know, shaky, low-resolution video shot on a phone during a riot, and catches those digital ghosts from a studio in California.
Yeah.
He translates that fleeting digital memory into a permanent tactile physical object using heavy watercolor paper and deep pigment.
And to add an even more massive leap to this timeline, that physical object born from a cell phone video in Cali and painted in California is later exhibited in the Art Fox and Nicoletta Gallery in Berlin in December of 2023. We go from a blood-stained intersection in South America to an international art gallery in Germany.
That incredible journey, I mean, from the street to the screen to a studio in California and finally to a gallery in Berlin, it just shows how the digital memory of a localized uprising can be transmuted and injected into the global art circuit.
If we step back and look at the whole journey we've taken today, it is staggering.
It really is.
We started with watercolor, a medium historically defined by delicate, peaceful landscapes.
Yeah.
We saw how Jairo Duque weaponized it, using rigid 640-gram paper to physically mirror the bodies of excluded youth who acted as human shields on the asphalt.
Right.
He used murky, aggressive water that doesn't soften but strikes.
And we examined how a claustrophobic composition and the aesthetics of scarcity, you know, repurposing swimming goggles and cut barrels into armor, created this non-hierarchical mass.
Mm-hmm.
And it was anchored by a monumental arm representing an upward collective will rather than a single dictator.
We saw the fragmented colors of the Colombian flag, reclaiming a nation for those suffering from 200 years of systemic abandonment.
Yeah.
We explored how actual street corners like Puerto Resistencia and Silloway were transformed into micro-societies where a new citizenship was forged. And we grounded it all in the real lives impacted, refusing to let the open wound of the protest be archived like a closed judicial file.
Through all of this, the central assertion of the source text becomes crystal clear.
What's that?
Well, in this context, true democracy and the recognition of these marginalized sectors were not handed down gracefully from official government desks. They were forged entirely by the physical friction and sacrifice of the youth who put their bodies on the line in the public square.
For you listening, it's a powerful reminder that history is often written by the sheer endurance of those who refuse to be ignored.
Exactly.
But as we wrap up, there is one final lingering thought from the source material regarding that incredible journey from the streets of Cali to a prestigious gallery in Berlin.
Yeah, this raises a profound question, one that is absolutely worth pondering long after this deep dive ends.
Go ahead.
When the visceral blood and sweat memory of a local uprising is transmuted into a polished piece of permanent art hanging in a prestigious international gallery, does it risk losing its raw, dangerous edge for the sake of preservation?
That's a great point.
Does the gallery tame the rebellion? Or is penetrating that elite global art world the actually only way the oppressed can truly ensure their history survives the official sanitized narratives of the state?
That is a heavy question to sit with. Does institutionalizing protest art save the memory? or does it steal its teeth?
Right.
It brings us right back to our very first thought. Maybe trying to play heavy metal on a harp seems mathematically impossible at first. But when you strike the strings hard enough, with the friction and the sheer force of a true popular uprising, the sound it makes is loud enough to echo from the blockades of Colombia all the way to a quiet gallery in Berlin.
And it's a sound that simply refuses to be forgotten.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, and we'll catch you next time.